You are listening to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton. I am a 34-year police veteran and the author of A Cop's Life and True Blue to Protect and Serve. Got a lot to talk about today, so let's just take a walk right into the briefing room, where I'm going to give you my view from the blue. Major story in the news, the major shootout in Philadelphia. Six officers shot. It started out as a warrant service on a narcotics case. Narcotics officers were apparently trying to serve a warrant on a second floor residence in a building. When they went in, an individual on the first floor, who was armed with a long rifle, just opened fire through the ceiling of his apartment and hit a number of officers, and then began firing at responding officers. What took place next was a 7 to 8 hour hostage negotiation. It was a prolonged gunfight. Officers returned fire. This individual, literally for hours, shot at police throughout the encounter. Now, it is an absolute miracle, and when I say that word, I'm not using it loosely, an absolute miracle that none of the officers received life-threatening injuries. What happened was the officers wound up being stuck in the second floor area, and they themselves had to be rescued along with several other individuals who were probably the suspects in the narcotics warrant. So a lot at play here. The work done by the Philadelphia police with bringing this confrontation to a peaceful resolution is something to be commended. But the fact of the matter is that this guy never should have been out of prison to begin with. You know, so we are constantly hearing about tightening gun laws. We should be banning the guns, putting up red flag laws. Well, here's this guy. His name doesn't matter. 36-year-old felon with an extensive criminal history for weapons offenses. And he's the one being charged. So the fact of the matter is he was legally barred from possessing a firearm. In fact, he was convicted in federal court of illegally doing just the same thing, being a felon in possession of a firearm. And he's got just an extensive criminal history. So why wasn't he in prison? Why wasn't he in prison? Well, let's ask that District Attorney Larry Krasner, who has been a strong proponent of basically decriminalizing everything. This is a symptom of why we are having the issues that we are having with gun crimes. There are no recriminations. There's no accountability when violent criminals violate the law. So why shouldn't they? Now, Krasner touted his office's disinterest in prosecuting people for things like marijuana and said that as a result of focus on more serious crimes, the caseload dropped at the DA's office. So really? Well, then how come, Krasner, you allowed this violent offender to walk the streets? This is the symptoms of what we're seeing around the United States with activist district attorneys whose goal is some sociological adjustment and allowing violent criminals to walk out. First of all, they're not even prosecuting for a host of offenses. So there's no accountability for offenses like theft and vandalism and even burglary in many cases, because their party line is that, oh, we've got to reserve our precious space in jail for violent offenders. Well, really, then why aren't you using it? You know, there are laws on the books, but if the district attorney's office does not do their job, and the judges do not do their job, which is to sentence people for these offenses, then what happens? These hardened criminals just get out and walk the streets and do exactly what they do, commit crimes. This is a perfect example of the breakdown in our criminal justice system. A breakdown because of activist prosecutor who is more concerned with politics than he is with the safety of the people. Now, I want to talk something else about what happened as a result of this incident in Philadelphia. You know, we have seen the disrespect to law enforcement officers just becoming an epidemic. We have developed a culture of confrontation in this country that's been going on now for years. And it's getting worse. It's not getting better. The New York City police officers who had water dumped on them a number of times, videotaped just walking away from it. And now that has spread around the country. Well, in this particular case in Philadelphia, you know, could it be more dangerous for not only the police but for the people in the neighborhood to have this maniac spraying lead all over the place? So the police are doing their damnedest. You're in a city area, an urban environment, and there's a lot of people. There's homes. There's folks walking the streets. And that, first of all, any bullet is dangerous when it's fired because you never know who it's going to hit. But especially a high-powered rifle, their range and velocity is much higher. So you have to set a perimeter up that keeps people safe. And you'd think that the people who are literally in the firing line would understand that and treat the police who are doing their very level best to keep them safe. You figure they would treat the police with at least a sense of normalcy, but no, not in Philadelphia. Well, probably not in a lot of other cities as well, but in this particular case, what was videotaped was absolutely mind-boggling. How the crowds gathered and taunted the police, pelted them with objects, some cases actually assaulted them, and all for absolutely no reason whatsoever other than the fact they were the police. And it doesn't appear that there were any arrests made. So this group of just uncivilized creatures, it looked like a zombie apocalypse. There were hundreds and hundreds of people gathered around the perimeter, and they were acting like just animalistic is the only word I can utilize. It was disgusting to see. And the Philadelphia police, they basically just took it, and they did their best to protect those people. It is astounding. It is disgusting. It is demoralizing. And those officers that stood the line out there, you could just see the disgust on their faces. Here they are simply trying to protect these same people from being shot by a crazed gunman. And they turn on them like rabid dogs. It was pathetic to see. And it is a symptom of what is going on all over this country. You know, when I talk about the war on cops, the war on cops is much more than just a physical war. It is a psychological war being waged by politicians, by social activists, in some cases, police administrators against their own people because of political repercussions. So what I've been seeing all over the country is this willingness on the part of politicians to literally throw the police officers under the bus at every possible occasion to further their own political ambitions. You know, I don't like to get political on this show as far as Democrat versus Republican versus independent. I try to keep the political, that those type of politics out of the limelight. But I can't, because you have two Democrat contenders for the office of President of the United States, Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, who blatantly accuse the police of murder. I mean, it's mind-boggling that these two accomplished women are so immoral that they are willing to lie to get elected. I guess I shouldn't be surprised at anything a politician does. But Democratic presidential candidates, Kamala Harris of California, Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, both in comments accused the Ferguson police officer, Darren Wilson, of murdering Michael Brown. Harris wrote, "Michael Brown's murder forever changed Ferguson and America. His tragic death sparked a desperately needed conversation and a nationwide movement. We must fight for a stronger accountability and racial equity in our justice system." And Warren tweeted, "5 years ago, Michael Brown was murdered by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri. Michael was unarmed, yet he was shot 6 times. I stand with activists and organizers who continue the fight for justice for Michael. We must confront systemic racism and police violence head on." Police violence? Police racism? Michael Brown committed a robbery and then attacked the police officer trying to take his gun from him, and he was murdered? It's astounding. The Department of Justice did an investigation. Every body of responsibility conducted an investigation into this shooting, and every one of them came up with the same conclusion. First of all, hands up, don't shoot, never happened. The greatest lie ever perpetuated by the American media and politicians of anti-law enforcement vitriol. And yet, even today, politicians like Harris and Warren, who are smart enough to know that it's nonsense and it didn't happen, they are willing to pervert themselves. They are willing to literally prostitute themselves, telling this lie about the police murdering this poor, innocent man because they have political aspirations. It's so disturbing to me that these are mainstream candidates, both of whom could be our next president. How frightening is this? Because if it doesn't frighten you, it damn well should. These people think that Americans are so ignorant that they will fall for these lies and elect them. And you know what? I hate to say this, but there's millions and millions of people across the United States that believe as they do. Well, let me say this. I do not believe for a second that Kamala Harris, who is a prosecutor, believes in her heart that the police did anything wrong. Because if she does, she is even more ignorant than I would give her credit for. I don't think she's ignorant at all. I think as a prosecutor, she knows exactly what happened. She just doesn't care because that narrative interferes with her political aspirations. So she's willing and agreeable to lie to the American people just to gin up votes and also fan the flames of hate against the police. How evil is that? How evil is it when allegedly respectable people elected to office of this country care so little for the men and women of the profession of law enforcement who are literally giving their lives to serve others? They care so little about them that they are willing to continue to fan flames of hate. Hate that actually has a nexus to violence against the police. It's unconscionable what they are doing. And yet they blithely go along their way, continuing their lies, continuing to cause even more and more division within this nation, and all because of their selfishness. It's not only disappointing, it's dangerous. And these officers who, you know, the three names that I read just today, gave their lives for this nation, for their communities, while serving and protecting, and yet they, even in death, are being maligned by the lies of these two politicians. I don't know if we're going to wake up in America in time. I don't know if there is going to be any accountability against those who would pervert the system, as these two and the district attorney in Philadelphia, who allowed this violent offender to walk the streets, all in the name of social justice. Only time will tell. But I have my feelings that this is going to get a whole lot worse before it gets better. That's my view from the blue. We do have a great guest waiting for us in the interview room, so let's take a walk over there. I want to tell you guys about a pretty amazing product. It's called Arrest My Vest Spray. And really what it's designed to do is, when you are wearing a ballistic vest, you know, it gets sweaty, it gets hot, it gets drenched, from working out in the street. And sometimes it doesn't smell all that well. And this is an amazing product that takes that odor away. And you don't even have to use it just for the vest. It takes pet odors away. It's great for your vest. It's great for your dog bed. Everything else that you need a deodorizer for, this stuff is amazing. Check it out. It's at stinkyvest.com. Go to stinkyvest.com. And check out Arrest My Vest Spray and arrest the odors. I want to tell you about a company called Law Enforcement Specialists. If you are an active duty law enforcement officer and you're looking to work extra jobs like security and traffic jobs, these are the people you need to go through. we all know that working extra jobs is what gives us the extras, gives us that little extra payment that we need, or perhaps gives us the opportunity to take our families out to dinner a little more often. And the only way to do it is to be working extra jobs. So what they do is they're all over America. I think they're in everything but a couple of states. And they work with your organization, your administration, and find off-duty jobs to work. You got to check them out. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com. And register with them, contact them. Now, if you have security needs, this is the company you want to go through as well. If you are looking for both security or traffic jobs, if you have a company that requires that, you want to contact these folks as well. They're good people. They're based in Arizona, but they have police officers and services all over the country. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world. To unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications. America Out Loud Talk Radio.
With me today in the interview room of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is a man on a mission. He is retired from the San Diego Sheriff's Department. He did 26 years as a law enforcement officer in a wide and varied career. But he's not done. He's not done yet. He has created a new YouTube television show called Journey to Justice. With me today is Pete Carrillo. Pete, thanks for joining me on Blue Lives Radio.
Randy, thank you so much for the invite. I sincerely appreciate it.
Oh, it is my pleasure. Glad to have you. Okay, first of all, let's talk a little bit about you. I know you don't. That's not really your favorite subject to talk about, but the fact of the matter is that we need to know who you are a little bit for some context as to what you are doing now. So you started your police career with the San Diego Sheriff's Office, and tell us a little bit about what got you into police work.
Well, it was the late 80s when I first entered this world. And but if I take you back to the 60s, my dad was a deputy sheriff here in San Diego County. And basically, I grew up watching him come home in undercover cars, and I'd jump in his car and play with the radio. Of course, it was off, but he was basically my mentor, and always looked up to him. So actually, in the late 80s, I followed in his footsteps and joined the department.
You know what? I wish that were happening more often today. Unfortunately, now a lot of officers are pushing their children away from policing as opposed to, you know, having them enter it. So you grew up seeing your dad, and so you joined the same agency he did. Was there any overlap? Did you ever get a chance to work together?
No, actually, he had transferred to the Federal Justice Department, and he went on to this illustrious career. He had worked Wounded Knee. I mean, I had some big shoes to fill, and I can honestly say that I haven't filled them yet. But no, he gave me a lot of experience. He got involved in politics, and you know, I got to see a lot. He started his own television show. He became a pastor. I mean, it is a long story, but at a young age, I learned about television and doing a radio show. I used to go with him, and he had a radio show. And so basically, it was all for a reason, I believe, because ultimately, with Journey to Justice, I'm kind of blending both worlds, the law enforcement world and using the media to tell our story.
Interesting. So your father mentored you in more than one way than just policing.
Absolutely. He he let me know that, you know, there's nothing too big, nothing you can't do if you set your mind to it. As a young man, I would travel with him all over. He became a Christian missionary, and I basically, with my brothers and sisters, we traveled and sang and that kind of thing. And so having a radio show and watching him produce his own television show was just very inspiring. And so when I joined the department, I was able to start making training videos. Even as a jail deputy, I was working on training videos and things like that. And just really always enjoyed that. I joined up with the Sheriff's Video Unit. And a lot of this experience that I'm now using, you know, I have to credit to the department, too, for all the learning.
So you've been interested in television production basically your entire life as well.
Absolutely. There was a point in San Diego here where I had been asked to assist with a church, and I actually produced a television show for them. So while I was working full time in the department, you know, I'd be up at 3 a.m. editing a show to go out. And, you know, so it was very interesting. A lot of time put in. My wife was very patient with me. But, you know, having a caseload and things like that, it was not always easy. But I'm pretty excited now about Journey to Justice.
So, okay, so you spent 26 years with the sheriff's office. And what were your assignments during that time?
Most of us back then, we had to start off in the jail. So I worked the jail, and I did about 4 years there, and then I went to patrol. Back in 93, I was actually involved in an officer-involved shooting. We had a suspect that actually had robbed a Pizza Hut, put about 11 people in the freezer, and unfortunately for the crook, he didn't know that there was a time-lapse safe, and he didn't know that there was an alarm in the freezer. So we set up outside, and basically the suspect fled the scene when he saw us, and I chased him over several fences, and fortunately for him, he pulled a gun on me. So I had to use deadly force, but and that kind of changed my life. That was a, you know, very eye-opening situation for me, and I realized, by the way, my father never used his firearm during his career, so for me, the first person I called was my dad, you know. Sure. I let him know what happened, and of course, my wife was extremely worried about me ever since then, and so it wasn't long afterwards that I ended up applying for and getting a position in public affairs, and I got... fortunately, I was selected to work in Crime Stoppers, but I should fast forward to after Crime Stoppers, I got to work in domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, and homicide as a detective.
Well, I would say you've had a long and varied career, and it led you to create your own show, and this... This is a really fascinating story. Talk about your idea.
So I did have this idea, and it was probably back in 2000. I was doing reenactments for Crime Stoppers, and I saw basically the power of, you know, the medium. I would put together these relatively unknown cases, and one of the first cases that really struck me was several migrants that had been attacked in a relatively affluent neighborhood in a canyon. Some juveniles had decided that they were going to basically, for lack of a better word, go hunt Mexicans, is the quote that one of the defendants used. And so this was a really small blurb in a newspaper here, and didn't get much attention. And so the chief of police at the time, Dave Bejarano, had actually asked me if I could do a reenactment, and I said, absolutely, whatever you need, sir. You know, the chief asks, you know, stand up and do it. So set about getting a similar vehicle description. I got the actors, literally went into the huts and spoke firsthand in Spanish to the victims, and it was really amazing because they cooperated with letting me use their property, well, at least what they claim is their property. And these gentlemen had all had permission to work here. So just to clarify that, it just so happens that they couldn't afford rent anywhere. So they were living in these canyons. And The attack was so bad that one of the gentlemen had been beat over the head with a metal rebar and drug into the bushes because the juveniles thought he was dead. So from going from a small little newspaper clipping to this reenactment, we had the chief had a press conference, was able to distribute the reenactment to these various reporters, and one of them was freelancing at the time for this, with the CBS News with Dan Rather. And the reenactment went national, and we got such a response over the weekend. It was nonstop airplay that we put that out on Friday, and by Monday, all five suspects were in custody.
That is amazing. And,
yes. So I was like, you know, the chief thanked me personally. It was very, you know, it was amazing because, you know, I really felt this sense of, you know, helping the victims was just beyond, you know, I think any officer listening would understand. And so at this point, I realized just the power of what I was doing, and what we were doing, I should say, because it was a team. You know, we had people answering the tip lines 24 hours a day. I had my partner from the police department, myself working for the sheriff. And we had officers that were actually shooting our reenactments, as well as we partnered with a local station. And so then our reenactment started going international because we had a woman who worked for Univision, and she was taking our reenactments, interviewing me, and putting them out in Spanish. And we actually got some calls from Honduras where some murder suspects were hiding. So it was just an amazing thing. So I told myself this, you know, someday I'm going to do a show where we just follow detectives around. I think people would watch, like a homicide team. And I'm kicking myself because I didn't do it. And then the first 48 came out a few years later, and it's a hugely popular show.
Your first taste of television, in essence, resulted in the arrest of five really bad hombres who were very, very cruelly attacked innocent people.
Yes, it was quite a story. And again, I said it went national, and especially in San Diego, it really highlighted the hate crime initiative here. And they put a special prosecutor on it. You know, they were all juveniles, and basically there was talk about trying them as adults. My recollection today is that they all ended up pleading out quickly because it was, like I said, it was a horrible crime, and I know there was a lot of compensation later to the victims and stuff like that. So,
right.
But there was a lot of community outrage. So, you know, to back up to what I initially said, this would have been a story that had gone by the wayside. It was a small... Back then we had newspapers, remember?
And, I think I remember, you know, them. Yeah, I remember those days.
And it was just a small paragraph on one of the inner pages, so most people didn't even know about it. But to take a little story like that, which really wasn't a little story, and bring it really to the front pages and really the top story, which is where it deserved to be, and then to ultimately help in a way to get it solved, was just an eye-opener for me. And so that was probably the first inspiration I had to, you know what, I could do a whole television show, and someday when I retire, I'm going to do just that.
Interesting. Okay, so let's fast forward now. What made you decide to retire, first of all? You had 26 years on, so you were eligible. But what was it that that made you make that decision?
Well, with all due respect to every leader of law enforcement agencies around, to be honest, as a line officer, we have to be honest and say that our agency heads are politicians, right? So
for sure.
It's, you know, in order to do anything like this, any time I would take a step to try and do something with the media, you know, you always have to have your department's blessing. And sometimes your department doesn't always agree with you. A case in point would be during my officer-involved shooting, that whole process, you know, I was accused of some horrendous things, like, for example, I'm part of a grand conspiracy to target African-American men and things like this, which is not true. Anybody that knows me knows I don't have a racist bone. And so all these horrible things were being said about me, and yet the department doesn't let you speak out, you know. So you have to just kind of sit there and you listen to all this press. And
sure.
Ultimately, I was exonerated in federal court after 6 years of the defendant suing me. I mean, this defendant in that robbery that I told you about, he was a serial criminal robber, and ultimately he accused me of trying to murder him, things like that. So I realized early on in my career that, you know, it doesn't matter how you feel, the department's not going to let you speak out, for obviously for reasons of liability. And I knew if I ever had wanted to do this television show, that I was going to have to basically leave the department and have my freedom to do it. So, and that's what I did in 2015.
You know, let's talk about just very shortly. You know, when you're involved in an officer-involved shooting, it is a life-changing experience. No matter how justified you are, you know, this becomes a life-altering experience. And then to be accused and basically railroaded into having to defend yourself in a public, very public forum, that can have a devastating effect on your life.
Absolutely. I mean, as you speak, it brings back memories of what happened. You know, I had been getting rumors for 6 years after the defendant went to prison that I was going to be sued in federal court for civil rights violations, et cetera. You know, and if you, taking it back to what I told you about my father, I mean, he was hired by the Federal Justice Department to basically assure that, you know, the brand new laws in the 70s of affirmative action, et cetera, were being followed. And so coming from a background like that, and then to be accused of, you know, civil rights violations, and the defendant was basically lying about the shooting incident, and I had to be defended by the county council, and it was this long process. And, you know, I'll fast forward to the end. You can imagine the defendant was pro per, representing himself as an attorney, and he was able to approach me on the stand and basically accuse me of being a murderer within 3 feet of me. And I had to defend myself, and we had an African-American judge who fortunately was very open to listening to the truth. And I let the defendant have it on the stand. I told them, I said, you have the audacity to come into this courtroom in front of this judge and accuse me of being a murderer when you know exactly what happened. You pulled the firearm on me and I shot you. And, you know, I have the transcript saved, so if we ever make it into a movie, I think it was a powerful moment. And I came back off the stand and I sat down next to county counsel, and he just looked at me and he said, you know, did you get it off your chest? And I said, absolutely. You know, because he knew that this had been with me for the 6 years of, and I thank God for the judge, Napoleon Jones, because he saw through the defendant's lies and basically told him to go to prison and do his time, and he wasn't going to get a dime. And so
that's,
I thank
awesome.
God for that.
Well, I like to hear a happy ending like that.
Yes.
so let's move forward in time and talk about your experience. So you came up with this concept, but it has not been an easy road for you.
No, if anybody has worked in Hollywood, and I know you know this, you know, sometimes the wheels in Hollywood move as slow, if not slower, than, you know, county governments, et cetera. So I had initially, you know, cashed out my 401k because I believed in this project, and I put a lot of money into it, and time and effort. And as they
well,
say,
talk,
blood,
talk about
and
the
tears.
Project so the listeners know what you're talking about.
Okay, so the idea I had was to tell stories of true crime, so basically true crime shows, from the perspective of a detective working the case. Because we in Hollywood, everybody tells our story. How about we tell our story? That was my idea. So I came up with this idea that when we work a case, it could be 2 weeks or 20 years, but it definitely is a journey, you know. And I met so many great detectives that would never give up on their cases until they were resolved. So the idea hit me that it is a journey. It's a journey to justice, really. And how about telling stories directly from the perspective of detectives? So I pitched this out to several producers in Hollywood. Fortunately, I have a great producer right now that I'm working with. And I could tell you that in shopping this around, so I spoke to a producer in New York. they wanted to make the show about me, to be honest with you. And it's kind of the standard that they have right now, where the detective comes on and just talks a lot about himself and the cases that he's worked. And I said, no, that's not what my show's about. The show's about me traveling around and talking to these great detectives about their journey. So you follow my journey as I tell you about their journey and the journeys of the victims and what the victims and the survivors have gone through. And so ultimately, a lot of them didn't get it. A lot of the producers I talked to, they, you know, there was talk of, you know, we're going to get somebody else to front the show. And ultimately, I decided, you know what, I'm taking this straight to the audience. And I decided to take it to YouTube. And the main producer I'm working with in L.A. Told me, you know, you have my blessing. And so here we are. I just debuted it the other day. And so far, it's getting a really good response, the very first premiere episode.
Let's talk about that episode. It's a fascinating story. And I think that, you know, if you give a little taste of it, so the audience knows what they're in for.
Okay, so I thought this was a good story to start off with. When I first got to Crime Stoppers and I started doing these reenactments, one of my partner from the San Diego Police Department, she says, you know, we had an actor here that was actually killing people. And I'm like, what? You know, that obviously got my attention. And so the very first episode is called Act One Murder. And it's just that we actually had a serial killer in San Diego that, while he was killing people, he was actually acting and helping the police department try to solve murders. So I guess you can't get more ironic than that, right? And so I decided...
That blows my mind.
Right. It's an incredible story. And more incredible than that is the fact that we had a tenacious detective, and I'll give you his name, Detective Rick Carlson. I mean, he's a legend here in San Diego. I happen to be in San Diego right now. And frankly, he is the hero of this case. And so to be able to meet him in person, talk to him firsthand, and just be blown away by his story, you know, I knew that this was going to be my first episode because it was just incredible. And I got a chance to sit down and talk to him, and he tells the story about basically from start to finish his journey to justice. And so I hope that was a good tease.
I think it was a good tease. So what, you've got one episode done. This is, yeah. How are you going to distribute it?
So basically I have, so going back to the Hollywood types, when I'm talking to all the producers and stuff, you basically have to demonstrate that the show has legs. So, okay, let's say we pick up the first episode. What other stories might you be doing? So I actually formulated a plan of action of two seasons worth. So I have about 24 episodes planned. And so I'm already shot, and I'm currently editing the second episode, and I'll put that up as soon as possible. And I'm pretty excited about it. I think, you know, with the list of stories, incredible stories, as long as the people support this online, which is part of the reason I'm talking to you, is hopefully to get some more subscribers. And again, I want people to be able to hear our stories firsthand from our perspective.
So I so appreciate what you're telling me, having negotiated the treacherous road of trying to bring forth television concepts. It is an exceedingly frustrating experience. As cops, we get lied to for a living, but
yeah.
You don't really expect that in the business world. And yet, especially in the Hollywood world, I've never seen a group of people that that is so untruthful. I'm going to be kind here and just call it a frustrating world.
Yeah, that's true. Having said that, I should say that I'm extremely grateful for the producer I'm working with right now, because he stuck with me through the last 4 years. He hasn't given up. He believed in Journey. With permission, I'll say this. When I first showed him the sizzle reel that we produced, he was so complimentary, and he would not stop talking about the quality and just the impact it had on him. And so that was extremely satisfying. And I knew we were on the right track with this. But I should say that in my last 4 years, I have run into several people, some of them with well-known names that told me they were going to take this show to the next level, and it didn't happen. So, and that's as much as I'll say about that.
Believe me, I feel your pain. I understand it entirely. This is something that, is very near and dear to your heart. You've put in tremendous amounts of time and effort and your own money to bring this forth. So, I really admire your tenacity and your dedication. The reality is that when police officers get involved in very dramatic events, those events stay with you basically for the rest of your life. So do you find that there is a certain catharsis to, I know as a writer, when I would write stories about my experiences or even about the experiences of others, I felt it to be, somewhat of a catharsis. Do you find that in producing a show as well?
Yes, so absolutely. You hit the nail right on the head. I can tell you, after 3.5 years of working the Crime Stoppers assignment, I was completely drained because I had met so many families, survivors of murdered victims. And, I basically came out of the job very grateful, but extremely drained, and, to the point that I actually teared up. And thinking about it now, it actually reminds me of that, because we carry such a burden in law enforcement for people. And I know there are a lot of people, cops like me, such as yourself, that actually care for people. And, a lot of times these victims are survivors are coming to you as a last ditch effort because their case is not solved. And they put their whole hopes, trust in you to try to solve their case. And all you can tell them is, I will do the best I can. So yes, listening to these stories firsthand, being able to tell them, it is a way of, as you said, it's cathartic. Journey to Justice for me, having heard all these stories over the years, and I'm sure there's probably a cop in Tennessee right now listening saying, I know exactly what he's talking about, because you live these stories as they're happening. Stuff happens right in front of you, and you're just blown away, and it's stuff you're never going to forget for the rest of your life. And now I have an avenue to tell these stories. Some of them I've been involved in myself. Some of them I've met the detectives firsthand, and I'm just blown away. Even that secondhand storytelling to you, it still affects you because you live sort of through your partners, and when they tell you what they just went through, like showing up at an officer-involved shooting, and it just happened, and, So, yes, absolutely. And to be able to tell these stories of these heroes firsthand from them is just, it's very, I guess I'll say, heartwarming.
I really admire what you're doing. So are you looking for other stories from law enforcement?
Yes, I actually am. I've been called the eternal optimist. Can you imagine that after 26 years in law enforcement?
I know what you mean.
Yeah, but no, I try to remain positive. And so, yes, I'm always looking for story ideas. I went to a convention recently of homicide investigators, and I had people coming up to me and pitching me their stories and giving me their business cards. So I'm always open to hear, potentially add their stories to my list. And so absolutely. And
how does someone get in touch with you?
Well, they can follow me at Producer Cop on Twitter, or they can follow me at Producer Cop on Facebook. Also, I have a Journey to Justice Instagram account, Journey to Justice TV, but they could also email me. Would you like that email?
Absolutely.
Okay, it's pete.carrillo007@gmail.com. And don't laugh at the 007, okay? That was actually part of my county ID. I'm always looking forward to, hearing people's stories And actually, I'm looking for sponsors too, because obviously the ultimate goal is to travel and be able to tell these stories of, again, that officer might have an incredible story in Tennessee, and as you know, it takes money to get there. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So, and where can my audience actually watch your show?
Well, if they go to YouTube and just run a search for Journey to Justice premiere episode, they should be able to find our first episode there called Act One Murder. And also, if they go to the Journey to Justice TV Facebook page, I've been posting there, and the link to get to the YouTube channel is there. And I would sure hope and pray that they would like it. And if they do, hopefully subscribe and support the channel.
So Journey to Justice, look for it on YouTube, subscribe to it, see some great stories, and I think that you will see some very high quality production here. You know, I know that Pete has been involved in this business for a long time, and the production value of what he's putting out there is top notch. So Pete, thanks so much for joining us here on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I really do appreciate your service to your community and what you're continuing to do today.
Thank you, Randy. I really appreciate the invite, and I just want to give a shout out to all my law enforcement brothers and sisters. Thank you for what you do.
There's something very important I want you to do for me. If you've been listening to the Voice of American Law Enforcement for any time, you know that we are very dedicated to the law enforcement community here. I would like you to go to a website. It's www.thewoundedblue.org. I want you to read about how we at this organization are aiding injured and disabled law enforcement officers. If you are a law enforcement officer and you have been injured or disabled and you feel forgotten and alone, this is why we exist. We have a fully trained peer support team, all made of police officers who have been shot, stabbed, beaten, run over, screwed up. They know what you're going through, and we exist for you. You are the part of the Blue family, and you deserve to be treated with respect and dignity. Unfortunately, many police agencies and cities do not treat their officers with respect and dignity when they are injured, either physically or emotionally. So go to thewoundedblue.org. If you are a citizen and you want to help, please check out how you can join the Wounded Blue. And if you're a police officer or have been, exist for you. So check out thewoundedblue.org. Now, I would also urge you to see our film. It is on Amazon, it is on iTunes, it's the Microsoft Store, it's pretty much every platform you can imagine. It's called The Wounded Blue, Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. You would be shocked at how the men and women of this, you know, the law enforcement community in this country, many are being treated with such disrespect. Many people, most people, even cops, believe that if you are severely injured in the line of duty, you're going to be taken care of financially and emotionally. In many cases, that is not true. Please watch the film and help the Wounded Blue.
End of Watch with Randy Sutton.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we pay our respects to the men and women of the profession who have made the ultimate sacrifice and given their lives in the line of duty. It seems like each week we always have at least one name to read. This week I have three names to read. The first is Deborah Johnson. Correctional Administrator Deborah Johnson was found murdered in her residence on the grounds of the West Tennessee State Penitentiary on August 7th, 2019. She was attacked by an inmate who then escaped from the facility using a tractor. The escapee, who was serving a sentence for aggravated kidnapping and rape, was captured 5 days later. He was charged with first-degree murder, burglary, and aggravated sexual assault and escape. Administrator Johnson had served with the Tennessee Department of Corrections for 38 years, started her career as a corrections officer. Correctional Administrator Deborah Johnson, Tennessee Department of Corrections, Tennessee. End of watch. Wednesday, August 7th, 2019. The second is Officer Andre Moy Jr. of the California Highway Patrol. Officer Andre Moy was shot and killed after conducting a traffic stop near the junction of I-215 and East Ridge Avenue in Riverside. As Officer Moy completed paperwork to impound the vehicle, the driver retrieved a rifle from it and opened fire. Despite being mortally wounded, Officer Moy was able to radio for assistance. Officers from the California Highway Patrol, Riverside Police, and Riverside County Sheriff's Office responded to the scene and engaged the subject in a prolonged shootout. Two other officers were wounded, and the subject was killed. The subject who shot him was an active member of an outlaw motorcycle gang, had previously served 10 years in prison for attempted murder. Officer Moy had served with the California Highway Patrol for 3.5 years and was assigned to the Riverside area office. He is survived by his wife, mother, father, and siblings. Officer Andre Moy Jr., California Highway Patrol. End of watch, Monday, August 12th, 2019. The third officer to give their life in the line of duty this week, Deputy Sheriff Stephanie Shores of the Lyon County Sheriff's Office in Iowa. Deputy Sheriff Stephanie Shores succumbed to injuries sustained 4 days earlier in a single vehicle crash on K-52 near Rock Rapids, Iowa. Her patrol vehicle left the roadway on a sharp curve, entered a ditch, and rolled over. She was flown to a hospital in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where she remained until succumbing to her injuries. Deputy Shores had served the Lyon County Sheriff's Office for 24 years. She is survived by her 4 children. Deputy Sheriff Stephanie Shores, Lyon County Sheriff's Office, Iowa. End of watch, Tuesday, August 13th, 2019. May they rest in peace. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I would urge for you to check me out on Facebook under the voice of American law enforcement. I do want to hear from you. If you have suggestions for the show, please contact me there and let me know. If you are a Twitterer, you can contact me at LT Randy Sutton. That's my Twitter account. And that's it for social media for me. Of course, that isn't true. I shouldn't say that. I guess I'm also on LinkedIn. And if you want to communicate over there, that works too. So thanks again. Make sure you check out thewoundedblue.org. And feel free to contact me if you have any suggestions or comments at my page, The Voice of American Law Enforcement, on Facebook.